We are joined here live in the KODX studios by Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I just want to say happy 20th anniversary of the WTO protests.
Happy N30.
Yes, happy N30. Yeah. It's also, I also want to point out, too, that this month is another very important anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the Native American occupation of Alcatraz Island.
Yeah,
November 20th, 1969. That 18-month occupation of Alcatraz was, I think, a pivotal moment in Native American rights struggles. It led to other occupations and other demonstrations throughout the early 70s. So we should give props to our elders in that case, the folks who not just were there, but who supported that action.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
So, and there's a whole bunch going on both here locally regarding N30, which we'll get to at the end.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that at the end.
As well as things happening across the country that we're not going to get to.
Yeah, right now you can get ready to, you should probably prepare to go get out the door and get down to town hall for the workshops and speeches and things that are going on for the N30 anniversary celebration.
And dress in layers.
Yeah, because it's a little chilly out there, though the sun's out.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some good actions in the evening, too. So make sure you take some layers with you, because as the sun goes down, it gets even colder. So.
And be careful when it gets slippery.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of slippery, the council wrapped up the budget this week.
Yeah, the city council, Seattle City Council, had their final approval of the budget this Monday. The council approved the final version with just a couple of final changes made to it. Number one was the change to the language in the Shama Sawant and Teresa Mosqueda's proposal, kind of joint proposal for funding one new tiny home village. Sally Bagshaw had added wording to say that the money could be used for either a new tiny home village or an enhanced shelter, and that the new village slash shelter must prioritize referrals from LEED, the navigation team, and the municipal court. Lisa Herbold and Shama Sawant spent some time over the weekend negotiating a little change in the wording. The change that was made reads that the new shelter village will, quote, prioritize accommodating referrals from the navigation team, law enforcement assisted diversion program, that's the LEED program, and Seattle Municipal Court, as long as the referral is appropriate for that program model, end quote. And what this language means is that it ensures that the new village or shelter wouldn't be a sober only shelter that couldn't take people who currently have drug and alcohol problems and have not yet been through a drug treatment program. Now, the language to use the money for either a tiny home village or an enhanced shelter stayed in the budget. So that was the compromise that was made. The other final change to the budget is Shama Sawant's original proposal to cut an additional $222,000 from the Seattle Police Department's $1.6 million recruitment and retention program to fund youth diversion programs was reworked by Sally Bagshaw into a proposal to cut $222,600, excuse me, from the Seattle Police Department's overtime budget to fund youth programs with groups like Youth Consortium, Creative Justice, and the Rainier Beach Action Coalition. So in the end, Shama Sawant, on behalf of a lot of folks, particularly folks from communities of color who had been arguing that the city shouldn't put hundreds of millions of dollars into a new youth jail. They should instead put these more modest amounts into very, very important and very successful youth diversion programs to help end the poverty to prison pipeline, that Shama Sawant on their behalf won the full additional $522,000 and then some for youth diversion programs that she had originally proposed.
And that also came...
It just came out of different parts of the budget.
Yeah, but that also happened because of significant public pressure organized during the budget process to push for that.
Yeah, but you need one city council member who will stand up and make the proposal and keep bringing it back and bringing it back and saying, okay, well, you gave us $300,000, but let's have the full amount. And that's what Sawant did. And
agreed, but
she didn't do it. And you're right. She didn't do it alone. There were some very vocal and very adamant groups that pushed various city council members to really keep at it.
And solid elected officials, I've heard this over the last 20 something years that we've been doing this, regularly point out that they can't do it alone, is that they need to have public pressure helping them along to enact the changes that need to be made.
Because in the past, Sawant has made proposals like this during the budget process, and she'll keep bringing them back and bringing them back throughout the process, and they don't get passed and changes don't get made because there isn't that support from the public. So when there is something very important, it's important like this that needs funding, you know, it's good for the public and for activist groups and social justice groups to keep looking at the city budget process and saying, okay, we've got a city council member who will work on our behalf. Let's go in there and support him or her.
Definitely.
So as part of the vote to approve the budget, the city council also approved Mayor Durkin's proposal to add a 57-cent tax on all Uber and Lyft rides, with some of the revenue going towards a new driver support center. But most of the money is going to go to affordable housing projects and to multimodal transit projects. Those could include the City Connector streetcar, light rail tunnels for West Seattle, the Ballard light rail line, or subsidies of transit passes for seniors or disabled folks. Durkin's budget originally proposed using the money primarily for the City Connector streetcar, but fortunately, the city council broadened that list of things that it could be used for, the transportation piece.
To things that are actually useful.
To things that might actually be useful and not be just a black hole for lots of city money.
Well, and which are essentially, again, those streetcars tend to be essentially a little perks for developers.
Yeah.
You know, look at a cute toy train that runs outside the building.
Oh, yeah. No, I think we can see that once the first Hill streetcar started operation, that the redevelopment of the Central District just really took off. So these streetcar lines really serve, I think, as a way to boost property values, to help developers rent out apartments in parts of the city where you really, for example, in the Central District, like 12th and Jackson, you can walk to downtown from there. But the developers who own land there and the apartment building owners are really pushing hard for the City Connector streetcar because they see it as a way for folks who rent in that part of the city to get quickly and easily to jobs in downtown and South Lake Union. And that has driven up the rents in that part of the city, too, with the idea that, oh, if we can rent these apartments to tech workers in downtown and South Lake Union, we can charge way more for these apartments. So the budget will now head to the mayor's desk for her signature. And Durkin has already, her office has already released a glowing press release on the budget. So I don't think she's going to refuse to sign it. I'm pretty sure she'll sign it as is.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Glowing press releases.
Yeah.
Are those done in special rooms?
Taking credit, I should say, for some of the changes that the city council made in the budget.
Always.
Which is always always do, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, don't all mayors pretty much do that? Some more than others, though.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on the budget?
No.
Let's move on. Also this week at City Hall, we had a new city council member took the vows.
Yes. Alex Peterson is the new Seattle City Council rep for District 4. On Tuesday, Abel Pacheco stepped down as Seattle City Council rep for District 4, and Alex Peterson was sworn in. Pacheco had replaced Rob Johnson when he resigned this spring to work for the NHL. Pacheco's position was as an interim council member until a new one could be elected. Legally, his term ended as soon as King County certified the election results, and that was on Tuesday afternoon.
So that's why none of the other council, the new council members were sworn in.
That's right. They'll be sworn in next year.
Okay.
Now, one of Peterson's first moves was to appoint four staff members, one of whom is Toby Thaler, a conservationist and land use lawyer who worked on the appeal of the environmental impact statement for the MHA upzoning legislation that was passed by the City Council earlier this year. The other three staff members are Alexa Holling, former chair of the 43rd District Democrats, Kara Katashima-Valle, formerly a paralegal in the Seattle City Attorney's Office, and, you know, forgive me if I mispronounce some of these names, and Lorna Murray, who is VP, Vice President of the Magnuson Community Center Advisory Council. Now, in Peterson's inaugural speech, he disavowed the use of PAC money in elections and praised Lorena Gonzalez's proposed bill to ban PAC money in Seattle elections, ban and or limit PAC money in Seattle elections, even though Peterson himself benefited from the Seattle Chamber of Commerce's PAC money. I found that really rich and kind of ironic. Now, then he proposed creating two new city council committees, a climate change committee and a committee on fiscal accountability, although he didn't explain how the climate change committee would differ from the new Green New Deal advisory board, which is being set up under the Green New Deal legislation that the city council passed this year. And nor did he explain how his proposed fiscal accountability committee would differ from the city auditor's department, because the city council has the power to request that the city auditor's department do various audits of projects and or departments within the city government. So, you know, since the city auditor's department already exists, why would you need a separate committee on the Seattle City Council? So I didn't see that as a very promising beginning there, you know, unless the main issue that you care about is opposing all forms of upzoning. Having Toby Thaler as one of his legislative aides might make you feel pretty happy.
Well, it depends on which side of upzoning you're on.
It does. It does depend.
And those could have been his proposal for those things. And again, I have no idea. I hadn't seen his plans, but could have just been campaign promises that I will propose to do this and that.
Yeah, I know he made some big promises to the businesses in the university district that he would look very closely at any efforts to upzone the Ave. Try to make sure that they wouldn't be displaced by higher buildings, by developers who want to build higher buildings.
Yeah, as is occurring here in the U District.
Which is already happening, yeah.
So that's going to be an ongoing
issue.
Subject that we'll be coming back to over and over again.
In the original MHA, the university district was removed from that because of protests over gentrification and the displacement of small businesses. But the city council has it as part of their task list to come back and look at upzoning the Ave. So whoever is the District 4 rep is going to have a pretty strong say in that.
Yeah, and again, we're talking about the Ave and not the entire university district. Mm-hmm. So people often get those two confused. And
other parts of the university district have already been upzoned
significantly, and a lot of that driven by, in addition to the standard developers, the University of Washington, which is the elephant in the room that pretty much calls the shots for anything happening here in the U district. They're like the godfather for the U District.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of the small businesses along University Way have banded together into a business association to try to counteract the influence of the University of Washington and of outside influences like real estate developers who want to come in and make a lot of money off of buying properties along University Way, tearing down the one-story and two-story low-rise commercial real estate and then build their own much taller buildings with apartments and ground floor retail. And that ground floor retail in those brand new buildings, the rent is so much higher that it just drives these small businesses out of the community.
Yeah. And then they're replaced by
chains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Generic chains that come in with their shiny new signs that look just like the signs on every other neighborhood.
Yeah, so your neighborhood, which had a lot of diversity before, can end up looking an awful lot like every other neighborhood that's already been gentrified throughout the city.
And country. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Moving on, the city and county made some changes to the Regional Homeless Authority.
Yeah, Mayor Durkin's office and King County Council members announced this week that they are making changes to the governance plan for the new Regional Homelessness Authority. The initial plan had two different boards running that agency with a really confusing mix of responsibilities parceled out between them. The new proposal will give elected officials on the King County Council, the Seattle City Council, and city councils in other participating cities, if they sign on, to have much more say over policy decisions, hiring and firing, management of the agency, and overseeing the budget for the Regional Homelessness Authority. Now, suburban cities in particular were very wary of the original proposal, saying it would have given King County and Seattle too much power over the Regional Homelessness Authority. Both the King County Council and the Seattle City Council will be looking at any change that's proposed by Mayor Durkin and the King County Executive, Dow Constantine, and the King County Council. And they'll be debating it and figuring out whether or not this is a good change and if there are any additional changes that need to be made. Now, that legislation that sets up the new Regional Homelessness Authority is going to have to be voted on by both the King County Council and the Seattle City Council. And then it will go to both Mayor Durkin and King County Executive Constantine for signature, just like any other legislation. The original plan was to have that legislation done, signed by both of those folks in November, but now it looks like it's going to be at least mid-December, and it could be even later, depending on what other issues might come up.
Well, luckily, homelessness isn't really a big issue currently.
What? You live in the same city I am, Mike.
And not like winter weather is hitting us anytime soon.
Yeah. And, so, you know, the budget, there were some changes made to the Seattle City budget because of all this, because the budget is for 2020 next year. And the assumption originally had been that the Regional Homelessness Agency would be set up and well underway by, you know, January, February. And that's just not going to be the case. You know, even if the legislation gets passed and is hammered out and finalized by mid-December, it still takes several months for the transition. So they're looking at, you know, April or May, maybe now and perhaps later. So the money that was set aside in the 2020 budget, there were some changes made saying, OK, well, the Regional Homelessness Authority is not going to get set up in January. It's going to probably be March. And now the later it goes, the more changes are going to have to be made later. And in the meantime, you're right. There are a lot of folks living on the street. The weather's getting cold. And
they have opened up for this week. They opened up all the overnight shelters, you know, like at City Hall and stuff, and saying, yeah, when it gets cold, come on in. But again, they only do that when the weather gets really bad and it's very limited, seating. Very limited number of spaces.
Very limited space, yeah.
And anyway, and they're not always conveniently located. And first come, first serve. And, you know, you don't know if you're heading in a particular shelter, if it's going to be full or not by the time you get there.
And there are lots of people who don't like being in those shelters because they don't think they're safe and sanitary. Now, living on the street is not necessarily safe or safe and sanitary, but some of the folks who live on the street feel much more comfortable with what they know than going into a crowded situation where they don't know who's sleeping next to them or even in the same room. And that in itself is a barrier that has to be overcome in order to get people housed, is getting people to trust not just the service providers, but getting people to trust the facilities where they will need to go to transition off the street.
Yeah. And again, it emphasizes the tiny home villages, which was proposed, you know, in the budget, that didn't get much traction.
Yeah. Like I had said a couple weeks ago, Shama Sawant proposed a significant shift in funding to open 14 tiny new home villages because they are proving to be the most successful alternative for getting people off the street. And one of the reasons they're very successful is because they allow people to have a private place to sleep and a private place to store their belongings. And that's just not what you're going to find in emergency shelters. you may find that in enhanced shelters, but not always.
Right.
A lot of times
they're economical too.
Yeah, and a lot of times an enhanced shelter is bunks in a large room. They do provide you a place to lock up your belongings, and they are open 24/7, but they don't provide the same kind of privacy that the tiny home villages do.
And another item that was funded here right in the U District was safe parking spaces. But again, for a city this size where there's, they estimate like 2,000 people living in their cars, I think it's for the city and not the county.
Yeah, there's not room for 2,000 people at University Heights parking lot.
Well, no, there's only going to be like 10 to 20 at the max,
yeah.
You know. And again, straightforward economic solution is
1%.
Finding some space to park these cars,
yeah.
You know, for a limited period of time. And the city just keeps punting on this and ignoring that issue. So mm-hmm. something to think about when you're walking through the cold weather this winter.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to state-level issues. Judge weighing in on 976.
Yeah, on Wednesday, King County Superior Court Judge Marshall Ferguson agreed with the state of Washington, the city of Seattle, and other municipalities to put Tim Eyman's car tab law, Initiative 976, on hold until the court case over it is settled. That means that I-976 won't go into effect on December 5th as originally planned. In making that ruling, Judge Ferguson had to weigh whether charging people more for car tabs now and then refunding them the money later outweighs the effects if I-976 goes into effect. For example, if King County Metro cuts 110,000 hours of bus service throughout King County, that just can't be refunded later to people who rely only on transit to get to work right now. So he weighed those two options and he decided that, okay, it's less of an impact if we charge people more for their car tabs now, and then if I-976 is upheld in court, we just refund them the difference later. That's much easier for the city to do, and it has a much lower impact than if we tell people, you've been relying on bus service to get to work because you don't have a car. Well, sorry, your bus service is gone. That's essentially the trade-off that he made. The state attorney general's office, which is tasked with defending I-976 in court, is working to file an emergency appeal to ask the state Supreme Court to overturn this ruling before the December 5th deadline for the initiative to take effect. That's Attorney General Bob Ferguson's office. They argued in the judge's court that cutting car tab fees now wouldn't make much of a difference since most transit agencies in the state have reserve funds that will get them through the next few months while the case plays out in court. So in other words, they argued that Metro says it needs to cut 110 hours, but they really can keep funding that at least for the next few months. That cut wouldn't happen until much later next year. Judge Ferguson, however, disagreed, citing the high probability of appeals that would take the case to the state Supreme Court, a process that wouldn't just take a few months, a process that could take a year or more for it to finally play out, which means pretty much ensures that transit agencies around the state would have to make pretty steep cuts in their service, as well as municipalities like the city of Seattle and the state of Washington cutting basic road maintenance, which is also would also be hit by the lack of funding. Now, I-976 was passed by state voters earlier this month with a 53% majority throughout the state, although the county of King County voters voted against it, even though they have the highest car tab fees in the state, and we do have the highest car tab fees in the state because we pay the state fee of $30 plus a Seattle Transportation Benefit District fee of $80, plus a Sound Transit Benefit District fee. And owners of electric and hybrid vehicles in the state of Washington pay even higher car tab fees. Now, I-976 would cut car tab fees to a flat $30 and would cut about $4 billion in funding to state and to the state of Washington and to local governments, most of it for multimodal transportation, primarily transit, and for road maintenance. In his ruling, Judge Ferguson seems sympathetic to the plaintiff's argument that the title of the initiative was misleading, that it indicated that previous voter-approved levies would stay in place when the language of the initiative, the actual language of the initiative, overturns previous voter-approved taxes. Ferguson said of the plaintiffs that they, quote, have sufficiently shown that they are likely to prevail, end quote, in their lawsuit against I-976, and so he imposed the stay. Tim Iman was at the court hearing and tried to speak on behalf of I-976, but the judge shut him down pretty quickly since he's not a party to the lawsuit. Iman later complained to attorneys from the state attorney general's office that they're not trying hard enough and not using the right arguments to defend the initiative in court. In the meantime, Iman's trying to lead a boycott in which he's urging drivers not to pay their car tab taxes. Unfortunately, not paying or renewing your car tab taxes is a really great way to get pulled over by the state patrol and get issued a very, very expensive traffic ticket. So I would not recommend that and certainly not as a form of protest against funding transit.
Yeah, I don't believe Tim Iman is an attorney or lawyer.
So no.
And taking legal advice from him is kind of dicey.
Yeah, and in fact, I've heard that he and a group of his supporters have put together a legal brief that they wanted to file with the court in support of I-976, and that legal brief is a mess, literally.
Yeah, legal brief in quotes.
Legal brief in quotes, yeah. He's not a lawyer, and I don't think he has a competent,
has he played one on TV.
Competent lawyer on his staff.
Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. Other developments with that? That's yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Moving on.
That wraps up our local news for this week. I just want to say, too, if you enjoy our programming, if you tuned in this weekend because you can't do without us for a week, then consider supporting us. Go to our website at kodxseattle.org. We have a Patreon button at the top of the website. If you scroll down to the bottom, there's a PayPal button if you want to make a one-time donation. But we would urge you to consider supporting us on a month-to-month basis by clicking on the Patreon button and figuring out how much you can budget per year to give for local independent media.
That's right.
Yeah. And if you don't like, you know, going online, you don't like using your credit card for donations, you can write us a check and mail it to us. We will take checks of any amount.
Old-fashioned check written on paper. Slice of tree.
Yeah, you will want to make out that check to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
And that P.O. Box number again was?
45883. You're not writing it down as I say it.
And the zip code is 98145. I'm not writing it down because you have it in
trouble,
your head.
You're going to have trouble remembering this if you don't learn to write it down.
Anyway, we will probably repeat that at the end of the show, too.
Hopefully, if it's not clear to you by now, that independent media is a critical tool that we all need access to, and especially these days when corporate media continues to dominate, continues to swallow up other entities in town. You know, we've got our own Sinclair outlet here locally, you know, Fox outlet. We're down to one paper that pretty much is the Blethyn paper.
Our local TV stations have all been bought up by big national media groups, and it really has impacted the quality of their local news.
Our competitors are in tough times, you know. Not to riff on them, because KBCS over in Bellevue had a wonderful morning news show that ceased to exist several months back, earlier this year. So it's getting fewer and farther between for oases of sanity
and local news. So. And just reliable and good local news, hard to find.
So we're trying to hold it down here.
Particular good analysis of local news that is really hard to find. So, you know, if you value that, I would urge you, instead of using this weekend, as so many people do, to buy lots of crap for Christmas or just for themselves to take advantage of super, you know, Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals, I would urge people instead to donate to your favorite organizations, and that you should consider setting aside some money for independent media.
Yeah. And if it's not us, there's other great local independent media outlets for you to support.
Yeah, there are other good ones. The South Seattle Emerald is a really, really good one.
It's a great one. Marcus Harrison Green is back at the helm there, and I've noticed a distinctive change since his return.
Yeah.
I'm very excited about that.
A very positive change. And Real Change News is good.
Not that it
good.
Wasn't great before that.
Real Change News is good. Real Change organization itself is good. Yeah. And there are a lot of little local blogs and neighborhood newspapers that do a pretty good job.
West Seattle Blog does an outstanding job for West Seattle. So
there's Erica Barnett with her blog, She Is For Crank. She does really good work.
So there's lots of places that could use your support in the coming year. And we also have the end of the year coming up. So for those of you that are in the six-figure and up departments, consider making a donation, you know, so you can skate around taxes like we all want to do, just like Mr. Bezos. Don't we all want to be just like Jeff Bezos?
Earth on the Air Independent Media, which is our nonprofit, is a nonprofit. And you can donate to KODX and get a tax deduction for that.
Enough about that.
Okay.
I figured we could go a couple extra minutes on that because all the other stations are right in
in the middle of their fund drives.
Their fund drives, and we aren't officially doing a fund drive here. Yeah. So another reason why you should like us. All right, let's move on to national news and more developments this week regarding impeachment.
The impeachment news. Yeah, I thought it might be quiet this week on impeachment news, but it was not. No, it was a big week, very busy week. So let's take the changes chronologically. Late last Friday, early Saturday, the State Department released emails and other documents that showed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo working very closely with Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on the shakedown of the new Ukrainian government. One call between the two of them was arranged by Trump's personal assistant. This bolsters Gordon Sondland's testimony that, quote, everyone was in the loop, end quote. Now, the documents also show that Pompeo roped Devin Nunes, the top Republican who sits on the House Intelligence Committee, into this whole thing. Pompeo has made multiple statements, all without providing any supporting evidence that the Ukraine interfered in the 2016 presidential election. So he's a very strong supporter of that Republican fantasy that it wasn't Russia who hacked the presidential elections in 2016. It was the Ukraine. So I think Pompeo and Giuliani are co-conspirators there, along with the president. Now, on Monday, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson of the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia ruled that former White House counsel Donald F. McGahn must testify in the House impeachment hearings. Judge Jackson called the Trump administration's arguments fiction and said, quote, presidents are not kings. They do not have subjects bound by loyalty or blood whose destiny they are entitled to control, end quote. Hence, you know, in that quote, he's saying they're not above the law. A president is not above the law. The Trump administration, of course, is going to appeal the ruling. So McGahn is not expected to testify anytime soon, although he should. McGahn, as the lead counsel inside the White House, would have been at Trump's side for any decisions that required legal advice. He could provide some very important firsthand testimony to Trump's knowledge, motives, and actions in the Ukraine affair. In another court case on Monday, Judge Colleen Kohler-Catelli ruled that the Department of Defense must release documents related to the freeze on military aid to the Ukraine. She said those documents must be released by at least December 12th or through December 20th. They had the opportunity to release it within that window, but that she's saying they must release those documents. Also on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court temporarily blocked an appeals court ruling that would have required Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, to release information on his financial records and tax returns to the House Oversight and Reform Committee, which is investigating hush money payments that were made to porn star Stormy Daniels during the 2016 presidential election. Stormy Daniels has said that she has had an affair with Donald Trump. Now, the Supreme Court gave no reason for the injunction, and the vote was not released, and no justices issued a dissent. Typically, for the Supreme Court to block something like that, at least five justices would have had to agree. Sometimes they will all agree, but in this case, no record of the vote was released. Also on Monday, the House Intelligence Committee announced it would finish compiling its report and release it to the public and to the House Judiciary Committee shortly after Thanksgiving. That's the report on all of the testimony that's been given so far in the Ukraine hearings. Then it will be up to the Judiciary Committee to review the evidence in the report from the House Intelligence Committee. Then they can have the opportunity to hold more public hearings, usually with constitutional scholars and experts. And those are actually scheduled to begin next Wednesday, December 4th. And then they would eventually draft articles of impeachment. The goal appears to be, Democrats have said, to hold a House vote on impeachment by the end of the year. After that, the Senate would then be required to hold a formal trial. On Tuesday, the House Intelligence Committee released the transcript of closed-door testimony by Mark Sandy. He's an official in the White House Office of Budget and Management. Sandy had signed at least one letter to delay the release of the $391 million in military aid to the Ukraine, which is why they wanted him to come in and testify. In his testimony, Sandy said that at least two other officials within the budget office resigned after dissenting over the hold placed on the military aid to the Ukraine. Mark Sandy also confirmed that he was told that Donald Trump himself had ordered the freeze in a July 12th email from Robert Blair, the top aide to Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House chief of staff. So there again, we have yet another person testifying that the hold on the military aid came directly from Donald Trump himself. You have any questions, Mike?
No, go ahead.
Okay. On Wednesday, two people with the Trump administration leaked to the press that Donald Trump had already been briefed about the whistleblower's complaint when he made the decision to release the hold on military aid to the Ukraine on September 11th of this year. Trump was briefed in late August about the complaint, the complaint itself was filed on August 12th. Now, this directly contradicts what Donald Trump and his defenders have asserted, that he never knew about the whistleblower complaint until after the aid was released. Now, remember, the whistleblower complaint was released to the public, the full text of it, in late September. But remember, 2 days before Trump decided to release the aid, three separate committees in the House of Representatives, the Intelligence Committee, the Committee on Foreign Affairs, and the Oversight and Reform Committee, announced that they were opening investigations into Trump's dealings with the Ukraine, particularly because it was well known around the Capitol that a hold had been placed on the military aid and that there was concerns by someone within the Trump administration that this was not legal and that this was linked to a shakedown of the Ukraine to benefit Donald Trump. Now the press, so it was no secret. Now the press reported on this Wednesday, that Rudy Giuliani had deep conflicts of interest while working for Trump on the Ukraine shakedown. He was simultaneously pursuing personal deals to represent the legal interests of two former Ukrainian prosecutors. And these are the two prosecutors who the Republicans and Donald Trump are citing as key witnesses to the Ukraine's involvement in the 2016 presidential elections to support that fiction. The two former prosecutors are Yuri Lutsenko and Viktor Shokin, both of them accused of aiding and turning a blind eye to corruption in prior Ukrainian administrations. Those administrations were notably pro-Russia. Among the documents released to the press is one that shows Giuliani's signature on a document that mentions a retainer that Yuri Lutsenko would have paid him for legal representation. And this is at the same time that he's trying to shake down the Ukraine to force the new Ukrainian president to announce that he's going to start these investigations into the Bidens, but also into whether the Ukraine interfered with the 2016 presidential election. So essentially, you have Giuliani trying to make money off of all this too. The document that mentions the retainer that Yuri Lutsenko would have paid him for legal representation was signed by Giuliani, but it also contained wiring instructions for making the payment into Giuliani's company bank account. So, you know, you see something like that, it's on the letterhead. It looks pretty official. It looks pretty final. So that's pretty damning evidence, too, that Giuliani was engaged not only in working on behalf of Donald Trump's personal political future, but also working on his own behalf to enrich himself in this whole thing. Now, in another case of Giuliani's really deep conflicts of interest here, Rudy Giuliani has been representing Alejandro Betancourt Lopez, a Venezuelan businessman who's suspected of bribery, money laundering, and embezzlement of funds through Venezuela's state-owned oil company. Betancourt is an uncharged co-conspirator in an ongoing Department of Justice investigation and case against eight Venezuelan men, one of whom is Betancourt's cousin. Giuliani has played a key role in Betancourt's defense, even drafting documents and meeting with attorneys in the Justice Department's criminal division on September 3rd of this year to try to persuade them that Betancourt is not involved in that corruption case.
December 3rd of last year?
September 3rd of this year. Yeah. And this is even as Giuliani continues his job as President Trump's personal lawyer. And this is kind of simultaneously with all this work that Giuliani has been doing to try to push the shakedown of the new Ukrainian government. And this is another example of how Giuliani is using his connection to the president to enrich himself and to bring improper influence to bear on Department of Justice lawyers to benefit his other clients. So, I think this was some pretty damning evidence that came out this week.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So a busy week.
For Giuliani, for sure.
Yeah, not a great one for Rudy Giuliani. I mean, currently there's a lawsuit against there's an investigation and I think also a lawsuit against the two Ukrainians that worked with Giuliani to try to press the shakedown on the new Ukrainian government. But as part of that lawsuit, they're uncovering all this dirt about Rudy Giuliani himself. So I foresee a lawsuit against him in the future as well.
Yeah. Well, he's a pretty rich target.
Oh, he is. He is so. Indeed.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
We'll probably be returning to that next week.
There will be more.
All right. Well, you had prior been doing some research and analysis on the different presidential candidate positions.
And the different Democratic presidential candidates.
We pulled back from that for a little bit, but you've got some more this week?
Yeah, I wanted to do at least one more look at an issue that I think is very, very important. Now, I had been doing earlier this year this look at these Democratic presidential candidates through the lens of different issues that are very, very important politically for the United States. And also, you know, the qualifications of their job. Arguably, there's a couple very, very important things that the president does. One is the Congress passes new laws, and the president is tasked with ensuring that those laws are enforced and interpreting the law and determining how, in some cases, those laws will be enforced. A second very, very important part of the president's job, and I would argue equally important, is overseeing the nation's foreign policy. Not just being able to say this is what our foreign policy is, but deciding who our allies, you know, overseeing our relationships with those allies, pushing for changes in international law or in how business is done internationally, trying to bring other nations up to international standards of democracy. There's a whole lot of work involved in that and a whole lot of knowledge that's involved in that too. And I wanted to take a look at the different Democratic candidates and their foreign policy proposals and, you know, their experience. Now, first is Joe Biden. His slogan is leading the Democratic world. And I would say he's leading the Democratic. He wants to lead the Democratic world back into a Cold War mindset. That's what it looks like to me. So first off, he says he wants to lead by example, and he lays out a list of Democratic or list of domestic policies that he hopes will be an example for other nations. He wants to end the Trump administration's terrible immigration policies like family separations, the travel ban, and the Trump administration's attempt to end asylum, and all of the candidates say a similar thing. He wants to end the global gag rule and work on measures to address gender-based violence and women's rights globally. He wants to commit to science and government and bring back the words climate change. He would recommit to the Paris Climate Accord, as would all the other candidates in the race, and convene a world climate summit. He would like to pressure China to stop its Belt and Road Initiative, which subsidizes what he calls dirty energy projects for developing countries. He would return to daily press briefings at the White House, State Department, and Defense Department because the Trump administration doesn't think those are important. It's not important to communicate with the press in Donald Trump's administration. Biden would host a global summit for democracy within his first year in office to work on fighting corruption, defending against authoritarianism, and advancing human rights. He would recommit to international alliances, including NATO and partnerships in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And that's similar to what other candidates in the race say. And then he says he uses the language, quote, sustaining an ironclad commitment to Israel's security, end quote. He would end forever wars. That's the terminology he uses to talk about ending the wars in Afghanistan and the Middle East. And of course, we've heard that before, right?
Would that include the war on terror?
Yeah, no, he makes no mention of the war on terror. Instead, he says he will focus narrowly on Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which to me doesn't sound like an end to the war to wars in the Middle East. He says he will end support for the Saudi bombing of Yemen, but he wants to strengthen and modernize the U.S. military with lots of new and expensive weaponry. He would recommit to the Iran nuclear deal, work to denuclearize North Korea, extend the New START treaty, and modernize the U.S.'s nuclear weapons. He says, quote, the quote, purpose of the U.S. nuclear arsenal should be deterring and, if necessary, retaliating against a nuclear attack, end quote. And that is very much the Cold War mindset right there.
Yeah, that puts us right back in the middle of it.
It does. Yeah, he would, quote, unquote, elevate diplomacy by rebuilding the State Department, which I think any candidate would have to do, any Democratic candidate would have to do, given what the Trump administration has done to try to dismantle the State Department. Now, the second candidate I looked at was Elizabeth Warren. She, of course, has lots and lots of specific plans, and this really goes along with all of her other issues. She comes up with very specific plans. Her foreign policy plan is spread out, though. It isn't just under the foreign policy heading. If you go to her website and look, she has foreign policy aspects of a lot of her other plans. So I tried to look at a bunch of them and assemble a list here. She wants to reinvest in diplomacy and multilateralism. That's a fancy word for international alliances. She would bring the troops home from endless wars. Again, there's that forever war terminology. The endless wars, but again, she wants to stay vigilant regarding terrorism, so not an end to the war on terrorism. She would rebuild the State Department, doubling the size of the Foreign Service. She would diversify its employees, professionalize the ambassadors instead of just appointing big donors with no diplomatic experience, as a lot of past administrations have done. And she would start a university-level program for Foreign Service graduates, similar to an ROTC program. She would cut the Pentagon's bloated $700 billion budget. She's one of the few candidates who has mentioned cutting the Pentagon's budget. She would ban giant defense contractors from hiring senior Department of Defense officials. She would ban DOD employees from owning stock in defense contractors. She would require defense contractors to disclose the scope of their lobbying efforts and make the Pentagon zero emissions by 2030. She would return the U.S. to the Paris Climate Accord and end U.S. support for international fossil fuel projects through the Export-Import Bank and the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC. She would build trade agreements that strengthen labor standards worldwide and not just for U.S. workers. She uses the term raise the bar, and she mentions raising global living standards, which I think is the correct way to look at it. It should be all workers, not just workers in your own nation. She would require countries to adhere to a set of human rights, labor rights, and environmental standards before they can enter trade negotiations with the United States. This is quite different from what we see at international institutions like the WTO, where the idea is to dismantle or lower those standards in order to comply with international or global trade law. Warren goes on to say that she would also open up the trade negotiation process so that workers, consumers, and the public can comment on trade deals as they make their way through Congress. I think that in itself is very interesting. Now, at the same time, Warren says she would crack down on multinational corporate monopolies and corporate tax havens, something that previous presidents have tried to do and not been very successful at. She would invest in technology also to combat cyber warfare. So that's the Elizabeth Warren plan. Bernie Sanders makes the big policy statements that lack a lot of the specificity of Elizabeth Warren's plans, but could kind of encompass a lot of the same measures and perhaps ones that are far more to the left of hers. Sanders says he would make the central focus of U.S. foreign policy democracy, human rights, diplomacy and peace, and economic fairness. So those are his four things: democracy, human rights, diplomacy and peace, and economic fairness. Instead of unilaterally declaring war, he would let Congress reassert its legal right to vote on whether to declare war. He would also let Congress assert its right to end wars too, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. He would end U.S. support for the Saudi bombing of Yemen. But again, Sanders doesn't specifically mention ending the war on terrorism, although I think he has spoken out against it in the past. He would revive the Iran nuclear agreement and revive talks with Iran over other issues, including human rights and democratizing their political system. He would work with pro-democracy groups around the world to resist forces of intolerance, corruption, and authoritarianism. So that's the gist of his foreign policy. Like I say, these big policy statements that lack a lot of the specificity of the other candidates, particularly Elizabeth Warren's, but could encompass a whole lot more liberal policies and liberal actions. Now, or I should say left of liberal actions. Now, the other two candidates I want to look at are Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris. Pete Buttigieg, he's a former Navy lieutenant who served in Afghanistan. So his focus when it comes to foreign policy is all security related and seems to be highly centered on the military. He would set a new and higher standard for the deployment of U.S. military force. And this is a direct quote. "It's time to put an end to endless war and focus on how best to use America's strengths to address future threats," end quote, which sounds a lot like a shift from an old set of endless wars to a new set of endless wars. He talks about climate security. So I find it interesting that the one big global issue that is not military related right now is global warming, and he manages to make that sort of militaristic thing as well. He would, quote, "reinvent institutions of international engagement," end quote, and he gives no examples of what that means. That's very vague and a little strange and ominous to me.
Yeah, and militaristic as well.
Yeah, he would like to, quote, "reverse the rise of authoritarianism abroad," end quote. And while that's not militaristic sounding, when you look back at the history of the U.S. role, particularly using the CIA and special forces to overthrow foreign governments or to influence foreign elections. That can be really ominous language when you say reverse the rise of authoritarianism abroad and all your other language is very militaristic. It makes me think, okay, here's a president who wouldn't be afraid to actively use the CIA to interfere with the elections or the processes of other nations' governments. And so that's all that I could really find on Pete Buttigieg's foreign policy. So Kamala Harris, she, in her foreign policy statement, she comes out swinging at Donald Trump, but sometimes she ends up sounding just like him, which I find really strange. And again, some of her language is contradictory. And this is a direct quote, "America must fight alongside friends and allies, not alone." She would reinvest in alliances that Trump has 86, like NATO, the UN, and get this, the World Trade Organization. She's a big WTO supporter, apparently.
I'm guessing she won't be at any of the local events.
No, I'm guessing you won't see her at our at town hall today.
Okay.
Her list of world threats include cyber warfare, Russian aggression, and interference in our elections, China's unfair trade practices, a spread of terrorism in the Middle East. So again, she's for the war on terror, and white supremacist threats at home. She will work with allied nations to end wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, but she'll do it responsibly by consulting generals and ambassadors. As we all know, consulting generals when you're talking about ending war typically doesn't lead to the end of wars. She will re-enter the Paris Climate Accord. She will reinvigorate the State Department and Diplomatic Corps. And this is a direct quote again, she'll continue her unshakable support for Israel and work towards a two-state solution so that Palestinians and Israelis can govern themselves in security, dignity, and peace, end quote. And all I can say to that is good luck. because that's been the goal, and showing unshakable support for Israel's current attempts to break down the Palestinian state is not exactly leading us towards a two-state solution. Harris has also said, and this again is another direct quote, she'll stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, but without isolating the United States diplomatically and risking an unnecessary war, end quote, whatever that means. Just looking over the rest of her foreign policy stuff, she's just very much a hawk, she's just not an isolationist one, which is what Trump is. So there you have it. Those are the foreign policy plans of the six leading candidates. Biden's plan looks backwards towards the Cold War. Sanders and Warren's plans take the spotlight off the military and put it onto global corporations and ensuring human rights and labor rights and so forth. Sanders is expressed in very broad policy statements, and to find out what he really thinks, you have to know his history, his political history. And Warren's is in very specific detailed plans because she doesn't have as much of a political history as Sanders does. Buttigieg is a militarist, period. His rhetoric is all about security, and he views everything through that lens. And Kamala Harris is pretty equally militaristic, just on behalf of international capital, much like Hillary Clinton was. And I make that statement because of her support for the WTO and so forth. Now, the Democrats will hold their sixth debate on December 19th in Los Angeles, California. It will be hosted by PBS NewsHour and Politico. And the moderators will be Judy Woodruff, Amna Nawaz, and Yamiche Alcindor of PBS NewsHour and Tim Alberta of Politico. To qualify for that debate, a candidate has to have 200,000 donors and either get 4% or more in at least four eligible national or early state polls, or get 6% support or more in at least two eligible polls from the following states: Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. So far, only six candidates have qualified: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, and Amy Klobuchar.
All right, we got to go to events.
Mm-hmm. Next Saturday, this Saturday, November 30th, is the 20th anniversary of the protests that shut down the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, a.k.a. the Battle in Seattle, and which some of us old-timers call N30. Right now, there is a workshops and speakers at Town Hall Seattle. That's down at 7th and Seneca. That started at 9 a.m., but it's running until 5 p.m. If you miss that, you can show up at the Northwest Film Forum. They're showing This Is What History Looks Like, archival video footage of the 1999 WTO protests in Seattle. That's from 4 to 5 p.m. at 1515 12th Avenue on Capitol Hill. Following that is a street party, WTO Shut It Down, Didn't We?, a 20th anniversary celebration with guerrilla photos and video projections and music, including Jim Page, from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. outside the Washington State Convention Center at 7th and Pike Street. That's where the WTO was trying to meet that day 20 years ago. Right after that, there'll be a WTO Plus 20 party at the Vermilion Art Gallery and Bar with DJs and dancing. That's from 8 p.m. to midnight tonight at 1508 11th Avenue at Pike Street on Capitol Hill. Then Sunday, December 1st, is a celebration of the Domestic Worker Ordinance and a film showing of Alfonso Cuarón's movie Roma. That's hosted by Hand in Hand, Casa Latina, and the Meaningful Movies Project. That's 3 p.m. tomorrow at University Heights Center at 50th and University Way. On Tuesday, Lisa Fithian will read from her book, Shut It Down, about her consulting work for groups organizing civil disobedience actions from Occupy Wall Street to anti-WTO protests to the Standing Rock Reservation Pipeline protest. That's from 7 to 8 p.m. at Third Place Books, 5041 Wilson Avenue South in Seward Park. And then next Saturday, December 7th, is another WTO protest 20th anniversary with Joseph Stiglitz, an afternoon of workshops and an evening of speeches by Lori Wallach of Public Citizen and Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz discussing globalization and labor movements. That's hosted by the Washington Fair Trade Coalition. That starts at 3:30 p.m. at Town Hall, 7th and Seneca, next Saturday, December 7th.
All right. Also next Thursday, the Seattle Community Police Commission is encouraging people to attend a public hearing on the police contract. That's going to be taking place at Seattle City Hall from 5:30 to 7 p.m. They're looking for you to come and listen and then give your input as well. So again, that's this coming Thursday. Regarding the police contract.
And what time was that again?
5:30 to 7 p.m.
At
Seattle City Hall.
Seattle City Hall. Okay.
So. All right. So we'll plan on seeing you next week.
Yes.